recognize them as something different. And from the belief that the man walking in front of us is a different person from ourselves, we develop our concept of duality or multiplicity. Gradually, we extend this multiplicity to every area of our existence until we come to the conclusion that life is an infinite number of separate existences, an infinite concatenation of unfolding lives, each of these unfolding lives individual and special in itself, each one in a strange way separate from all others, and having only one means of communication, that is, by means of the phenomenal sensory perceptions or extensions of body by means of which we appear to be in contact with each other. Yet we have discovered from our own experience that no matter how closely we bring these bodies together, we never create unity. Forms always remain separate. Attitudes remain separate. Sometimes in our generosity of thinking we can share our thoughts with others. But it is impossible for any human being to say with certainty what is the basic thought of another human being. These basic elements are all separate and individual, so divided because each person is isolated or encapsulated within a structure of vehicles, these vehicles being the various bodies with which life itself is invested, as with garments. And we remember the wisdom of the Rabbi Maimonides, the great Jewish scholar, who always pointed out that the body of man is concealed within garments. Yet the body itself is a garment, concealing something else within itself. The same is true of religion and of the law. For the garment of the law is called the Torah, which is the vestment which it wears. And the body of the law, which is beneath the garment, is called the Mishnah, because it is for the wise, for the Hasidim. And within the Mishnah, as within the body of man himself, is a spiritual entity. And in the law, this is called the Kabbalah, or the unwritten tradition. Therefore, it is written in the Torah that the letter of the law killeth, but the spirit of the law giveth life. So everywhere in existence itself, where embodied things exist, these bodies are the basis of illusion. They are bondage upon the person to whom they belong and separating barriers between that person and all other persons. And no matter how we struggle with the objective bridges which we have created, we can never completely overcome the interval of body. So far as the exchange of idea or belief or knowledge is concerned. Therefore, we must take this knowledge also and embody it. And by embodying it in words, which are also vestments, we are able to pass this embodied knowledge to another person. But in placing it in a body, we have also limited it, restricted it, and made it subject to the interpretive power of the individual to whom we speak. And if he does not interpret this embodied idea as we intended, we have no way of knowing for certain whether he has actually received the idea which we communicated or has merely used this communication as a means of supporting attitudes which he previously held. We do not know. But we do know that due to the circumstances around us, we are limited as far as body is concerned, to the body of the universe, to the body of nature, to the body of law, to the body of covenants, to the body of cities, to the body of families, institutions, all things. We must live in our own body in an embodied world. And that part of the world which is not embodied, we do not understand. In order to see anything, it must have a form and be visible to us. In order to hear it, it must have a sound body. In order to touch it, it must have a form body. In order to taste it, it must have a taste body. Everything that we accept as an experience into ourselves, we receive as a body imparting to a body. For it is our own sensory embodiments which receive the impressions of the body contacts with other things. Thus we live in a world of second-hand transmissions, a world in which we can never transmit that which is essentially real. The least thing we can ever do with such transmissions, perhaps, is playful, where we come strangely into a world of mysticisms, in which the poetic use of language has been used from the earliest date as a means of rarefying communication, so that it is less prosaic, less profane, less physical, and being more subtle, carries a little bit of the overtone which we are seeking to communicate. The Tibetan Buddhist philosophy, therefore, realizes that all efforts of all kinds to extend man's material knowledge to the acquisition of truth must fail, because the only truth that the body can know is embodied truth. The only reality which the body, which man can physically contact, is a physical reality. And all such physical things are merely symbols, no more true, actually, to the spirit that inhabits them than our own body is a full expression of the consciousness within us. We would hate to be completely accepted only by body. We would desire at least to be accepted for our thoughts, for our communications above a physical level. We are also, however, surrounded by an infinite number of forms with which we cannot communicate, in which our only knowledge is that of their bodies. Such forms are animals, birds, insects. Such forms are comets, suns, moons, and planets. These cannot speak to us. Therefore, they have no way of appearing except through the eyes. Sometimes we may hear certain sounds that they make, as Pythagoras heard the music of the spheres, and we can hear the song of birds. But though we have this means, this communication is not actually conclusive so far as sharing and experience is concerned. Thus we are surrounded by innumerable bodies that are inarticulate, or have dimensions of sensory expression beyond us, so that we are not able actually to contact or understand them at all. The Tibetan takes all these inarticulate bodies, takes all those mysterious forms which we seek to understand, and places them on his altar as a series of extraordinarily designed figures. Each one of them, the letter of an alphabet, each one of them, the picture of a reality. Each in a sense, a three-dimensional representation of a power-dimensional fact. Now the purpose of this pageantry is first of all to cause the human being to develop a new attitude towards the explanation or discovery of the meaning of things. It becomes obvious that the only way in which we can find out what these great truths mean is to become totally receptive to them, no longer to inquire, but to be still and permit the natural processes of our own consciousness to reach out and solve the mystery without the help of the mind and without the help of the emotions. This, to a sense, therefore, represents the discipline of higher yoga. It is to know without permitting the various sensory perceptions to condition knowledge, that by conditioning it, they destroy it. They reduce all things to the level of their own conditioning. And the truth must be discovered by man raising himself until he experiences truth with the most truth-like part of himself, which is his pure consciousness. Eastern philosophy has always assumed, therefore, that there can be a transmission in pure consciousness. Now, this must not be regarded as extrasensory perception. This is not a psychic communication. This is not thought communicating itself to another mind by mental process only. But when thought communicates, it is on the level of thought. And whether this thought be communicated verbally or transmitted mentally, we are dealing with the same level of value. The thoughts thus communicated belong to the world of thought. But what we are seeking for belongs to a world that completely transcends thought. The only hope that we have in the solution of this problem, as pointed out in the papers of the Esoteric section of the Theosophical Society, is that man himself can perfect the instrument of pure knowing. That in some mysterious way, his own nature contains within it the possibility of being developed into an instrument of pure consciousness cognition. Man has so many potentials that it is difficult to determine what their natural limitations might be. One thing we know, that the entire structure of human society is nothing but an externalization of man's mental and emotional levels of knowledge. We have created humanity at its present level of growth simply by externalizing the potentials of thought and emotion. We still have further to go in this if we wish to externalize them completely. But although we have not exhausted their potential, we are beginning to question their validity. We are beginning to realize that we cannot trust our own thoughts and emotions, and therefore we cannot trust the society they create. If our own thoughts and emotions were infallible, they would produce an infallible society, but they are not. They represent merely a series of stabbings at reality. They are a burning after something, but never catching it. They are a motion, a thirsting after reality. But in this case, the thirsting, as Buddha points out, is ineffective. We are thirsting after a conditioned state. We have preconceived what we want. We think we know what we are going to find. And by this previous decision, we invalidate the process itself. Because actually, we have no idea what we are going to find. We assume that it will be consistent with what we have already discovered. But this is an assumption. The reason why it is an assumption is that we are assuming that processes that are not mental will produce the same type of knowledge as processes that are mental. And that which is discovered by consciousness will merely be an extension of that discovered by mind. This is not necessarily valid. We have no reason to assume that this must inevitably be true. So in our yoga and in our development of this type of thinking, the whole of our ancient learning, especially in Asia, was aimed first of all at trying in some way or other to discover the facts of things. The reverse procedure to the one with which we are familiar. Western man has built on trial and error, hoping that in the end he will attain to the knowledge that he needed in the beginning. The result of this is that he has built a civilization by trial and error, which has been mostly trial and a great deal of error. We are now trained to defend the most primitive of our notions. It is as though we appointed, or had appointed at some remote time, a group of small children to make our laws, and then for the rest of eternity bind ourselves to obey these laws. We try to assume that out of the gradual process of evolution, we will ultimately attain a condition in which we may achieve security. But in the process of so doing, we simply destroy ourselves turn after turn, wipe out culture after culture and civilization after civilization, because each of these proves inadequate. And man himself must continually outgrow the arbitrary limits which he placed upon his own growth. Easterners started out with an entirely different concept, and this is really probably the key to East-West relationships psychologically. Eastern man at a very ancient time decided that the most important thing in the world was to discover the fact. What is the truth? If we cannot know it completely, we must know enough of it so that we will not build from the beginning a culture entirely contrary to it. Now, it is obvious that when we ask for such a situation, when we ask for realities, when we ask for truth, we are asking for the most valuable and precious and difficult of all things. We are asking for the highest type of genius of which man is capable. We are asking for an insight that we have scarcely dared to bestow upon anything but God himself or the avatars which he has sent into the world as his messengers. We have assumed that even the prophets have not yet achieved this degree of insight. So what has happened? There is much evidence, of course, that for the most part, Asia did not accomplish its end. It did not discover these tremendous realities in a manner that was practical or useful. But one thing did happen. They produced, by a special art or science, a group of teachers. These teachers probably did not attain to the absolute ultimate, but they did attain to a very high degree of insight. They were not able to form a way of life from the absolute knowledge of the divine plan, but they did approach close enough to the suburbs of heaven to discover at least some of the principles of that plan. So they began on a higher level of insight than Western men, because they valued insight most. They valued the internal above all other considerations and were resolved to fashion the external world into the likeness of the internal need. As a result, there were a number of schools established down through the ancient world, especially in Asia. A few also in Egypt and one or two in Greece, which were devoted almost exclusively to the production of the person of insight, who was to be the natural and inevitable leader and guide of mankind. And in this development, there was this gradual unfoldment of a secret system of instruction. Secret because it was concerned with an end or goal opposite to that of the average person. Man wanted success in this world. This was exoteric knowledge. A few wanted to know the mysteries of God. This was esoteric knowledge. But the ancient pointed out that just as surely as man could build a vast structure of material knowledge to satisfy his curiosity concerning the material world, So he could likewise evolve within himself extraordinary inner arts and sciences for the satisfaction of his spiritual curiosity concerning truth. As a result, a whole pattern of processes was established. Within this pattern developed in Hinduism, developed originally probably from the great sages and rishis of the Veda, and finally an adaptation was shared with Buddhism, the Jains, the Sikhs, and many other Indian groups, even moving into Persia to influence the Sufis. Some, of course, affirm that actually the beginning was in the Persian area and was finally brought into India. But regardless of its exact location, there evolved a great transcendental doctrine. This doctrine was believed in, accepted, and venerated in the East, and generally disbelieved in the West. It seemed incredible to Western men that consciousness could move in two directions. To him, consciousness could only move into objectivity. It never occurred to him that there was another direction or dimension by which consciousness could move backward into itself to explore an inner world, an inner life, and was not merely an outpouring of energy for the mastery of a physical environmental situation. So man continued in the West to master his environment and lose control of himself. In the East, man tried to gain control of himself, and as a result, largely lost control of his environment. As a result of losing control of his environment, he was subjugated by numerous foreign powers and considered his life strangely tragic. But actually, his life was far more profitable and meaningful than can actually be appreciated by others, because it was a journey of the one to the one. It was a journey inward to that reality which alone is significant. So we have the discipline set up by which the person is going to extricate himself from the bondage of the objective directing of consciousness. Obviously, he cannot go on accepting, affirming, and adjusting to the infinite diversity of objective phenomena if he wishes to go in a contrary direction. He must determine his goal, he must decide what the values are, he must make up his mind, and then he must proceed according to his intent. As Buddha pointed out, the beginning of this process was the gradual disentanglement of the mind from the hypnosis of objectivity. The individual must stop affirming that the earth beneath his feet is the reality. He must discontinue the belief that he is every day on the verge of finding the answers to everything. All he is finding is an answer that asks more questions. He must stop affirming or believing that his own existence is to be satisfied by continual involvement in matter. Even if he becomes king of this little earth on which he exists and extends himself further to master other planets, he is still born, suffers, and dies, and is still unable to attain the true state of insight or security. To meet this challenge, a way of detachment had to be established. And in many countries, this way of detachment was monastic. The individual had to make a clear break with the illusionary world. He could not serve two masters at the same time. He had to determine which one he would serve. He also realized that when he tried to compromise and attain both ends, that he spread himself much too thin. He could not achieve his purposes. For the pull or the mysterious gravitational force of materialism continued to drag him back into the satisfaction of his sensual intellectual desires. And in so doing, reaffirmed the reality of his outer life over his inner quest constantly, until this reaffirmation became practical and hypnotic force. Though the truth seeker in ancient times was therefore inclined to make a clean break with all those attachments which must inevitably tantalize him and demoralize him if he did not clearly affirm his true devotions and his true loyalties. In Sermon Buddhism, therefore, the renunciation was the complete giving up of the life of the person whose interests were purely of this world, the life of the householder, the life of the merchant, the life of the businessman, or even the professional man. All of these essentially had to be left behind. The individual had to cut himself off from every entanglement by means of which his consciousness was bound to the illusionary state. He was not strong enough to be constantly in the presence of temptation and not be tempted. Therefore, he had to remove temptation by binding himself to obligations of renunciation, by decreeing and declaring in the presence of witnesses by oath and by testimony that he had rejected the shackles of illusion, and that he was resolved to dedicate himself totally and entirely to the quest for reality. Once he had achieved this complete severance, he then had to begin the process of bringing his body into servitude. Not only did he have to get rid of the world around him, but he had to get rid of the worldliness within him. To do this, he had to re-educate every part of his own nature. He had to rise above the cravings and requirements of body. This he did by extreme austerity, by fasting, by various penalties and punishments, which he visited upon the flesh. He accomplished this by the religious ways of flagellation and of the torturing of the body, anything to destroy its authority. It was against this attitude also that Buddha raised his voice, declaring that all abuse of the body was wrong, that the body was not to be tamed by abuse or by beating, any more than men are to be governed with a whip. And the answer here lies that men will obey if they understand. Therefore, the bodily purposes must be revealed. Man's relationship to the body must be enlightened. He is not intended to destroy the body. He is intended to make proper use of it. Therefore, in yoga and other systems, the gradual bringing of the body into line with the purposes of consciousness has to be achieved. The body must learn to attain quietude. The person must learn to relax the nervous system. All agitations of emotions and thoughts which disturb the quietudes of the body must be overcome. The body must be allowed to be what it is intended to be, a simple instrument of purpose, an instrument which has its proper rights, an instrument entitled to adequate nutrition, proper sanitation and hygiene, an instrument never to be abused, for all abuses of it will result in karma, but an instrument never to be catered to, never to be indulged, and never to be allowed to fall into dissipation. Where to allow these things to happen is to damage the body itself. If we allow the body to become spoiled, it is like a spoiled child, which will ultimately turn on us and accuse us of destroying its integrity. Having achieved a fairly high measure of bodily discipline,
as represented in the fakirs and holy men of India. Then the disciplines were turned to the emotional life, where the individual was taught to refine, regenerate emotions, to purify feelings, and as the Buddhism to gradually transmute all personal emotions into the one great emotion of compassion. The tremendous sympathy for all that lives, but a sympathy completely non-personal, a sympathy that is not touched, or in the sense that it is allowed to develop any personal desires, personal ambitions, personal reactions, but the entire life being dedicated, as Buddha says in the Nitya Sutra, to the highest form of spiritual love, the heart doctrine. That love of self, love of vanity, love of things, love of persons must finally be transmuted into the infinite love for all that lives, and the infinite admiration for the tremendous universal process which makes achievement possible to all that exists. So that we reserve our deepest devotions, our deepest affections, for the wondrous workings of the eternal laws of being. Then the name must be brought under submission. The name must be taught the difference between its use and abuse. The name must be taught that of itself it cannot solve the mystery. It must be taught to release itself from the arrogance of mentation. It must end the hypnosis of the I and the importance of me and mine. It must recover from all pride of thought, all dependence upon intellect as an excuse to justify personal emotions and vanities. It must achieve humbleness in all forms, rescued from the conceit that the mind can know the truth. Whereas in reality, it can only become an instrument of truth-seeking to a certain point, where it must relinquish its authorities to the heart and to consciousness itself. By the time the aspiring soul has achieved these degrees of unfoldment, the individual comes to the threshold of yoga itself. The idea that it is something merely to be used as a trick, as an excuse, a validation, is wrong. It is not like any drugs, stimulant, peyote, anything of this kind, an artificial means of creating intense internal apperception. Yoga is not a way of growing without growing. It is merely a means of avoiding the responsibilities of growth and at the same time achieving clarity and insight. In all the legitimate schools of Eastern thought, yoga comes as the culmination of the preparatory disciplines. To achieve yoga, the individual must also have attained the highest degree of personal regeneration. From this point on, the journey inward and upward toward the reality goes on at a much more accelerated rate. It becomes more powerful and more immediate in its activity and in its accomplishment. But your Tibetan philosophy is built on this, that there is this road that leads to identity with reality. That this road can be walked by man. And that the great patriarchs, the great Buddhas, and the Bodhisattvas are the ones who have walked this path and have become the elder brothers of mankind by, in one way or another, transcending the limitations and restrictions which have been placed upon the average person by his bodily pressures. The Tibetan joins with other Asiatic peoples in the acceptance of the Bodhisattva obligation
In other words, the entire theory involves the mother-like concept, not a single embodiment. The growth of man as a conscious spiritual being, a growth which may be against the stream of the common development of the average body of persons. This growth, which is learning to go upstream against the current, it begins with an obligation taken to the self, an obligation that cannot be taken lightly, an obligation which represents the factual dedication not only of the person's life, but of all coming lives, to the end of time, dedication to the attainment of truth. Not to become a vessel of truth, but to become identical with the substance of truth. Once the obligation has been taken, the great processes of growth go on. But the individual in whose nature the Buddha seed has been planted is presumed to be reborn again and again with this dedication, until finally, in the fullness of evolutionary procedure, this dedication impels the consciousness to the life of the Arhat, impels the achievement of the Bodhisattva state, and finally leads the being to the full liberation through Buddhahood. This concept, of course, constitutes a kind of ladder, a ladder of ascending steps. This ladder was actually taught and appreciated, so far as we can learn, by the members of the great university at Lhasa. They had to do with this substance, this recognition of a secret art or a secret science of regeneration and rehabilitation of consciousness. Thus, instead of this Eastern philosophy leading to the Western concept of the Superman, it led gradually and inevitably to absolute integration with life itself. This is why, in the West, we seemingly are desperately afraid of quietude. We fear that if we relax, this tremendous momentum of effort by which we seek to achieve will slow down and we will finish in frustration. In the East, however, the whole concept is to slow it down. That this tremendous momentum that we are trying to build up is meaningless. It is only destructive, because it is a momentum that cannot lead anywhere. There is only one answer and one end, and that is science. The only way in which we can ever attain the reality we seek is through the complete relaxation of ourselves. The complete ceasing of the personal makes possible the revelation of the impersonal. To the degree that the individual ceases completely to be bound by human limitation, he approaches divine insight. So in yoga, in all of this type of discipline, the most important thing is to maintain absolute internal tranquility. If this is lost, all is lost. And the individual becomes the dukkha or black magician. For the moment higher knowledge is related in any way with selfishness, we have the most terrible of all perversions. We have the corruption of the divine. We have, therefore, the unforgivable sin, the sin against the Holy Spirit. Actually, of course, esoteric Buddhism does not actually represent or recognize ultimate annihilation by sin. But it does recognize that voluntary and intentional perversion of spiritual power constitutes the most grievous fault which the individual can commit, a fault which must be expiated by great suffering through various cycles of later embodiment. The individual must attain this higher degree of purification and maintain it. In the early sections of the sacred doctrine, the cosmogenesis sections especially,
we find the concept of the evolution of the universe from infinite mind. We see step by step the unfolding of hierarchy. We realize that very largely this entire concept is derived from modern Buddhism. And yet we have to be a little careful lest we overlook the fact that even these great stanzas of esoteric symbols are themselves actual symbols. Every one of them represents something else. Every word of the story of the creation and evolution of the universe has many meanings. Most of all, it has a meaning of inner experience to the individual. We cannot accept even these most choicely chosen words literally. Always we must search for their inner content, their meditation meaning. We must seek for the mystery of what these words mean if taken into the completely tuneful consciousness of a totally accepting spirit or heart. This is why in the ancient rituals, for example, screens were set up to divide the sanctuary into certain rooms. These screens were ornamented with the figures and symbols of regions of space. And within these symbolical temporary tent-like structures, the various rituals were conferred. Every ritual being itself only a symbol of something else. Every word, every device used, every implement and instrument, having no actual substance in itself, but always having a meaning beyond itself. It has to be this way, otherwise we would be attempting the spiritual by means of the material. If any of these implements were factual, if any of the rituals were actually as the words express them, then we would be in the position of being able to communicate reality by word or by symbol, which we cannot do. We can actually communicate only a basis for meditation. Each conscious being has to take this symbol into himself, discover its meaning, explain it in terms of his own need, of his own expanding awareness, and know to anyone who believes that because he has passed through a certain ritual, he is now in the possession of some choice spiritual property. He is not. He is only being given a figurative representation of a mystery. The very ritual of which he is experiencing is a mandala. It is a drawing, a painting, an image of things in themselves utterly invisible. Things to be known and experienced only within his own consciousness. The only journey that we can therefore recognize is the one that was also sensed by the Neoplatonists, who may have been influenced by modern Buddhism. We are not sure about this. But certainly the Neoplatonists of Alexandria did possess many of the same essential principles or secrets. The whole problem consisted, therefore, of bringing the person, first of all, to an immediate experience of something transcendent. Thus, in the sanctuary, in the atmosphere, among the reiterations, the mantras, the chanting, the strange and unfamiliar symbols, the mysterious, tantalizing sounds of the ancient religious music, the strange, deep, shadowing clouds of incense, and through it all, the voice of the initiator communicating in his way and according to his understanding the great rituals by chant, by liturgy, by every means available. The purpose of this strange, involved, complicated, spiritual theatrical was to give the initiated person some glimpse of something beyond the commonplace. And here again the magic was also skillfully used, because these ancient priests and even their present descendants knew more about the vibratory harmonies of the body and of the mind and of life than one is dreamed of in our philosophy. And they were seeking definitely to create within the neophyte a temporary, momentary exhilaration by which he might have at least a slight experience of consciousness. They wanted him to feel consciousness moving within himself, awaking from the sleep of ages. They wanted him to be aware that he possessed powers to know, different from the common and familiar faculties. And the only way that he could ever know this is to have it happen to him. No amount of instruction could truly convince him. He might be impressed, he might affirm, he might believe, but it was not this that was sought after. The thing that was really desired was that the individual had the actual feeling of an extension of consciousness. Plotinus describes that this happened to him. Among the Neoplatonists, that he himself, on a few occasions during his life, was for an instant picked up and carried into the consciousness and presence of his God. Apuleius describes the same experience in the Metamorphosis, how through the very wonderful combination of every scientific means available to the ancient hierophants, the Neophyte was able to glimpse something of this region beyond. The same thing was attempted less successfully in China by the Hong Society or the Association of Heaven and Earth. The candidate had to experience something, not merely symbolically pass through the ritual. He had to know, for example, as a personal experience, that this ritual was symbolic, not factual, and that beyond it was something else. To create this move, to escape from this wilderness, all this strange paraphernalia was accumulated, to set up within the person a kind of decentralization of his points of fixation. The individual had to be, for a moment, confused as to the substantiality of his material focus. He had to be disoriented physically. He had to feel for a moment some uncertainty concerning the integrity of his material consciousness. He had to become aware that there was something beyond. And in the writings and mystical reports of Northern Buddhism, we find many accounts of these temporary elevations of insight, in which the person actually experienced something that he could never forget, and that became, so to say, the final assurance that the road he was following did lead somewhere, and that the teachers who were instructing him were able to actually accomplish what they said they could accomplish. It is all a very intricate and complicated situation, but it does center around one of the points that in Tibet is emphasized, although not quite in the same way as in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky. This point is the existence of a great invisible courage. The courage, as the ancients called it, of the 6 days' work. The courage of the labors of creation. Our labors which must only be culminated by the labors of regeneration. That there existed, therefore, a secret school governed over by arhats or adepts. That it has always existed in the world. That it stands more or less as an eternal remedy against the continual expansion of materialistic thinking. That it must remain and always must be the only process of instruction by which man can extricate himself from his constantly increasing material involvement. Now, if this involvement was leading to reality, if it was essential and necessary, it would be different.
But actually it is not. The answer is that we cannot achieve the ends which we desire by the means we are using. And for that matter, we do not even know the ends that we really desire. We are following a wilderness of illusionary knowledge, seeking to substitute our own thinking for the purposes and plans of the infinite mind itself. So the esoteric schools and the esoteric sections of various philosophical institutions exist for the purpose of gradually leading true seekers through the various levels of the hierarchy until finally the individual, through his own merits, is capable of an internal, conscious relationship with the great systems of spiritual education. But they must exist. Why? Because in the mind of the infinite is also the great teacher. Just as surely as the Buddha is represented as the perfectly enlightened, so he is also the world teacher. And within the cosmic mind itself is the infinite pattern of legitimate instruction. And this pattern of legitimate instruction is gradually integrated around a hierarchy of unfolding intelligences capable of administering this system of instruction. This system, which has as its end the fulfillment of the biblical admonition, be ye perfect. All secret societies in this world, all initiation rituals established among men, all the esoteric schools with their material, symbolical paraphernalia are therefore emblematic of the great school of the mysteries, the great school of eternal truth resting in the eternal mind. As therefore we may say that the infinite is infinite life, and thereby ensues all things, that it is infinite light, thereby revealing all things, that it is infinite wisdom, thereby bestowing wisdom upon all things, so it is infinite instruction, forever using the processes of creation as elements in a great system of education. Thus creation itself is the great universe, the university, ruled over by the hierarchy of initiate teachers. This was held in Tibet. This finds its way definitely into the teachings of H.P. Blavatsky and finally emerges again in her concept of masters, mahatmas, and initiate teachers. They have all been acknowledged, recognized throughout Asia as actually real beings, beings that exist as agents of divine purpose, just as surely as the sages and scholars and artists in other fields represent exceptional attainment. As man can produce only one Michelangelo or Leonardo da Vinci in a century, as we can produce only one great musician in a generation, as we can produce only one great philosopher in 1,000 years, so in the course of our evolution, certain beings, certain unfolding intelligences, achieve to a very exalted degree of insight and become the initiated bodhisattva teachers of their fellow men. And in selecting the names for her teachers and initiates, Madame Blavatsky followed rather closely the bodhisattva concept, always recognizing this order of dedicated beings forming the great white brotherhood, an organization of light, serving the Lord of light, and representing symbolically the whole of creation as the school of initiation. This is the thinking that we do get a trace of in the Tibetan system. This is what we find in India, where it has always been the policies of the gurus and the teachers to pass their most advanced disciples along to superior teachers, inasmuch as the whole system of gurus finally culminates in the Jagat Guru, the great teacher, who is one of the initiators of mankind. So all these processes are to be found, the necessary philosophy, and they are also to be found in the imagery, artistry, and mandalas of Tibet. And then through these degrees, I think it is obvious that H.P. Blavatsky was influenced by Tibetan philosophy. Well, our time is up, so that's all we can do at this time.